From McMaster University, I'm John Preston, and you're listening to Big Ideas for a Changing World. In this series, you'll hear from researchers from McMaster's Faculty of Engineering and beyond who are creating innovative solutions to our world's greatest challenges. I have the chance to see these solutions up close every day as the faculty's Associate Dean for Research and External Relations. The challenge we'll explore today is the urgent need for personal protective equipment, or PPE. On March 11, 2020, the World Health Organization declared the COVID-19 outbreak a pandemic. Since then, a worldwide shortage of PPE has put healthcare workers' lives at risk, as the very items that protect them while they care for us were in short supply. As you'll hear from one of our guests, Dr. Allison Fox-Ribichaud, there is at one point only a week's worth of masks for healthcare professionals in one Hamilton hospital. The need for a local solution was critical. That's when a team of engineers committed to working alongside Allison and her colleagues in the Faculty of Health Science and Hamilton Health Sciences. You'll hear from Ravi Salvanagapathy from the Faculty of Engineering, who spearheaded this effort and is now leading a Center of Excellence in Personal Protective Equipment and Materials at McMaster. But with me today, I have Ravi Salvanagapathy and Allison Fox-Ribichaud. I'm going to ask each of those to introduce themselves. Allison, can we start with you? Could you tell us about yourself and your role?
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Allison Fox-Ribichaud. I'm a critical care physician, an ICU physician in my clinical life, professor in the Department of Medicine, Faculty of Health Sciences at McMaster. And my research is about a disease called sepsis. But I also have a hospital appointment where I'm director of medical education. So I oversee all of the medical students and residents coming into Hamilton Health Sciences. So I have a couple of roles. And as Ravi was just mentioning, my research sepsis, I am the scientific director of a new CIHR-funded network that we're calling Sepsis Canada that has 190 scientists on. But Ravi and I have a long-standing relationship that's been almost 7 years now, including a CHIRP grant that we've held together to develop a point-of-care device.
Okay, and Ravi, could you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, so thank you for joining, everybody. I'm Ravi Salvanagapathy. I'm a professor in mechanical engineering, and I'm an associate member in the School of Biomedical Engineering as well. My research interests are primarily in microfabrication and microfluidics. So application of miniaturization technology in handling small volumes of fluids with application in things like diagnostics, discovery of new drugs, delivery of drugs, artificial organs, and so on. So it's very different from what we are going to talk about today. And I've been sort of, like Allison mentioned, collaborating with her over the past 7 years or so in developing devices for sepsis. And that, to some extent, was important in the genesis of this work and collaboration.
Absolutely. So we won't be talking about miniaturized microfluidic devices or sepsis very much during the remainder of this program. What we are going to talk about are the efforts to produce personal protective equipment for frontline healthcare workers, but also for others, and how that's led to a rich and robust program working with Canadian industry to develop a Canadian supply chain for these items. But I think the first point is to just maybe begin at the beginning. And can each of you try to take us back to the very early days of when COVID-19 was beginning to become an issue, both within the world and then later within Canada, and maybe tell us about how this collaborative effort came about to work on something that was very different from what you were doing pre-COVID?
So if you recall, way back in March, the WHO declared a pandemic somewhere around, I think it was the 9th or 10th, maybe it was a couple of days later. And because this pandemic started in China, we have been, as many people are in the world, reliant on China for supplying us personal protective equipment. And with the declaration of the pandemic and the shutdown in China, that supply chain was interrupted. And so on March 19th, after some meetings in the hospital, I sent an email to Ravi and to my associate dean of research, Jonathan Bramson, in the Faculty of Health Sciences, and said, maybe the Beam facility, because I was just thinking outside of the box, could help us produce PPE because we're going to have a supply chain issue. And that started a fury of emails on March 19th, with John getting included and a bunch of other people, to start to look at the problem and what the Faculty of Engineering could do to help us.
Yeah, I recall a similar kind of thing, in the sense that the email from Allison came out of the blue, and it started the cogwheels turning, right? And initially, our ideas were, could we look at using the manufacturing capability within engineering to try to get this done? And then quickly, we realized that the magnitude of the problem was fairly large enough that we couldn't necessarily just use engineering capability. We need to reach out. And that's when it sort of became a bigger effort. And the other important thing was to bring together the team, right? So no single individual can do all of these things. And in engineering, the most impressive feature was this team building exercise. And that then led to the kind of response that that we saw.
So just to go back to those times, I remember them as well. And the initial, I mean, initially we were collecting masks and respirators that we had available already in engineering, and packaging them up to take them over to. But that was, I don't know how many days supply that was, or how many hours supply. But I remember being quite taken aback when I was told that, you know, thousands of masks and respirators were acquired each day locally in Hamilton at Hamilton Health Science and at St. Joe's each. That the idea that we would somehow be handcrafting masks was a little bit naive on our part. So, Ravi, you mentioned the team building exercise. Can you give a sense of how long it took to get a functional team together, and what were sort of the key elements of that?
It didn't take very long. I mean, compared to the scale that we used to operate in research, I mean, I remember that, I mean, getting a graduate student would take several months, and processing all paperwork and so on. Here, what we had, luckily for us, was the university was in shutdown, research was all stopped. And therefore, there was a number of faculty members and students and technical staff in machine shops and so on, who did not necessarily have their regular day-to-day duties and were also very extremely eager to contribute. So there was an initial team of about 3, 4, 5 faculty members and associated students that were put together very quickly. And then rapidly, it grew into a size of about 20 plus faculty members and 40 plus students and research staff involved in the effort in making personal protective equipments. And I think there was a sort of a slightly lesser but equal number of people involved in other aspects of response to COVID-19 work within engineering. So this was a significant fraction of people in engineering who got involved. And I was amazed by the amount of contribution that people were willing to make voluntarily, right? So there was a very palpable eagerness to contribute to the society as a collective effort. And that is something that I'm really proud of from engineering. Right?
Allison, can you talk about, I'm assuming that as this happened and after this initial email that launched all of this activity, you must have taken on, well, I know you took on additional activities within the hospital. Can you maybe describe how your day-to-day activities changed as COVID was starting to become an issue within Hamilton?
So for whatever reason, I had a bit of block where I was, again, the lab was being shut down. My clinical research was being shut down, and I didn't have any clinical time. So I spent my days between meetings at the hospital to ramp up our pandemic planning, and then making the connections to the engineering faculty to be able to move all of this forward. What I did was help make some connections, and their engineering faculty who had other connections. And probably the biggest one was to the manager who was in charge of the PPE supply. So Brian Harichuk had been tasked at the hospital level with looking at our supply chain. And he became the hospital side, and he and a couple of other people who are involved with N95 testing and other things became part of this team from the hospital side. We've added some other people subsequently, and Myrna Dolovich at St. Joe's, so we brought St. Joe's into the loop. And that started new collaborations anew. But my days during that sort of initial lockdown, everybody stay at home, was a lot of sort of more cloak and dagger almost, right? Because by that point, we started to get a bunch of masks. And we started really with the masks project. We need facial masks. And in the hospital, this was a huge moving target for us. What masks should we use? How much should we wear them? And even at the beginning, we weren't wearing masks all the time in the hospital. We had way back with SARS, almost a decade before, but we hadn't gotten to the point where everybody was wearing, and the literature had changed a little bit. We didn't know this virus as well. So we weren't wearing masks, but we knew we might get to that point as the pandemic continued to spread, and we weren't quite sure what was going to happen in Hamilton, and was it going to look like China? And so we started to look at the masks. And at this point, Dr. Preston starts delivering masks to my doorstep. and it's coming from unusual places. We could talk a little bit about some of those unusual places, but it's the community within sort of the region in Hamilton that actually stepped up to the mask production. And what we did at the university and how we sort of re-changed from, are we going to produce this, is how are we going to test this? Because it was clear that we didn't have, as we learned, the capacity in our area to test the masks to the standards for which we were expecting them to be used for healthcare workers. And just for the students particularly, a mask is not a mask is not a mask. And so the engineers rapidly learned a lot about what it took to make a hospital grade mask particularly.
Yeah, that would be fascinating to go back to those early days and some of the naive statements that might have been made. I'm, along with Ravi, I'm not only proud of people's willingness to step up, I'm a little amazed at how quickly they became sophisticated in terms of their appreciation of how masks work. Ravi, do you maybe want to go into a little bit more detail on that? Like, who within McMaster had pre-existing knowledge that could be brought to bear onto this? And can you tell us how some of the, maybe just some of those pieces maybe fit together?
Yeah, so, I mean, masks and other protective equipment like face shields, for example, ventilators was another sort of early concern and interest, and we did some development there. So all of these things were, to some extent, new to all of us, right? So there were bits and pieces of expertise that we could draw on. And this, again, for the students, is one of the key features of the university education, right? So unlike skills-based training, which gives you very specific training on very specific pieces of equipment or technology or whatnot, university education is more broad-based. We look at fundamental principles and so on. So whatever we apply in some area, we could use that knowledge and understanding and expertise into some equivalent other area if the problems are very similar, right? So in some senses, the masks and the filtration that we do to some extent is similar to what we do in other research, say, for example, in terms of water filtration, for instance, or in terms of surfaces and dealing with surfaces versus fluid flow at low Reynolds numbers and things of that sort. So we could apply somewhat similar principles, but it took a lot of new learning. And it took a lot of surprising directions because it was not purely academic in nature. It was also in terms of managing this rapidly disintegrating supply chains, right? So what we quickly realized was the filter material that goes into the mask is the key piece that is important if you want to produce medical grade masks. And that supply chain was rapidly disintegrating, and there is no quality place to actually get that tested. And so what we then did was to come up with a game plan that will, in the event of a crisis, support Hamilton Health Sciences by providing sufficient supply of masks. So this was sort of our worst case scenario planning for this purpose. And we identified that testing is very crucial. So we need to build a good testing setup. And Faculty of Engineering was generous with putting in that initial seed funding to build that infrastructure. And we brought in people in surprising places. So for example, our head of the mechanical engineering machine shop, during his master's about like 15 years ago had apparently worked on very similar setups, right? And therefore, this was a fantastic find. And he was able to put together these setups fairly rapidly in order to get those masks tested. And once we had that capability, we became then a resource center to the local companies who were eager to see Canadian testing for these masks.
Allison, you mentioned about, I'll call it uncertainty, and how the shifting framework of what was understood about both the virus itself, but also about appropriate treatments and protective measures. Can you maybe give us a sense of what it was like in those days, and also maybe comment on how serious was the shortage of personal protective equipment? How far out did you have supply for?
So there were a point where some of the masks that we would normally wear, we had less than a week supply. So if we had had any more cases coming or the supply chain had totally broken down, we would have not been able to do our usual care with a mask. And there was a rapid change in the hospital. So it went from, we don't wear masks routinely for anything except if we're doing a procedure, to everybody in the emergency department wanting to have a mask on anytime somebody came through the emergency department door, and educators trying to figure out what is the best standard and what masks we should be using, to, okay, now we're just going to wear masks in the ICU and the emergency department, to now everybody in the hospital is going to wear masks. Now visitors are going to wear masks. And it's sort of progressed like that. So you can imagine our supply chain too. Now you're going to wear masks, but you're not going to change it and take it off and on. You're going to have to wear a mask all day. And what mask are you going to wear? So are you going to wear an unrated mask? And masks, the regular sort of hospital mask that you see, has three levels. And those have to do with their ability to filtrate. And so who's going to wear what level mask, depending on whether you're patient-facing or not patient-facing. So it was this huge shift, and every day you'd go to the educators, oh, and this has changed, and we've decided we're going to wear this, and now this group is going to have to wear masks. So it was totally confusing. You know, even for me at the leadership position, it was confusing for the frontline staff because the messages were changing so frequently. And that was just in the hospital. And now, as you started to hear in the media, it was worse in particularly the retirement homes, but including the long-term care facilities, who were supposed to have a pandemic plan, but many of them didn't have it to the extent that they needed to.
Yeah, I think that's something it's hard to convey to the public, just how great the challenge of working in that kind of an environment day after day. Ravi, I think on the engineering side, maybe the risks weren't the same because we weren't dealing with patients, with infected patients. But maybe you can comment, at the time when we got started, when you really started assembling your team and bringing them together, how certain were you that you were going to be able to contribute and actually produce quality PPE?
We weren't. So it was as dynamic as Allison is describing, except in the sense that we were uncertain whether we would, the efforts that we were making would be of any use at all, right? In the sense that the goalposts were dynamically changing as the crisis was evolving. And we had to adapt from an engineering perspective in terms of the kinds of masks that we want to develop, as well as in the kinds of materials that we want to deal with or the testing facilities. From a planning perspective, it has been pretty constant in the sense that what we have always thought of is as the last stop measure for Hamilton Health Sciences in case everything breaks down, right? So that was our purpose. We would be really happy if the capabilities that we develop and so on were not used at all, right? Because that would mean that Hamilton as a whole survived fantastically well, and so it wasn't very useful. So that is sort of the mentality that we took, although it ended up that the work that we did got a number of companies involved in making of the mask, and therefore from a long-term perspective in terms of PPE, Canada and Ontario has now more of these companies producing these masks and supplying to hospital systems and so on. So supply chain has been relatively relieved. So the effort has outcomes, but that was not the expectation for as long as we've been involved in this project. And that way, we were able to manage expectations very easily.
So Allison mentioned the time when I dropped off masks to her home, maintaining physical distancing appropriately during that time so that Allison could then take it into the hospital setting for testing and to get feedback, which was particularly good. Ravi, can you maybe comment on how important the feedback from the staff? And of course, some of that feedback, maybe you can comment. I mean, this is potentially life-saving equipment. So someone would assume comfort would be a secondary consideration. Can you maybe comment on that take?
Yeah, so I think the comments are very valuable. And this goes back to this design thinking philosophy that as engineers, we should have is this constant feedback from potential users of whatever we are building, whether it's a medical device or a commercial product or whatever it is. There is a mentality that we often tend to think from a technical perspective, does it meet the technical specifications and so on? But then we often ignore other things like the feedback or the usability of it, as well as the perspective of comfort, wear, and so on, which often trumps, right? The use and helps propagate the use of the devices that that we would be making. So feedback from Allison, for example, in terms of the ability to use and the scenarios that were emerging in the hospital in terms of how these PPEs were used, really was crucial, not only for the engineering team, but also for the companies that we are working with in designing suitable modifications that could actually enable the users of these pieces of equipment to wear them comfortably, better, over longer periods of time without necessarily causing discomfort, right? So for example, breathability is a very important concern, which from if we were not having this feedback from Allison and her team, we would just simply think of it as a pressure drop measurement, right? And we would meet that specification. We'll try to meet that specification, but not necessarily lower that significantly so that it becomes much more comfortable for use of the end user, right? So a number is not just a number as long as you don't visualize this from the perspective of the end user, then that number carries a different kind of weight. And that is what we learned as a team in this interaction with personal protective equipment.
All right. I want to change gears a little bit. So we've talked quite a bit about the early days of the pandemic and, you know, laid the groundwork for how it was going. How have things evolved? Allison, what's the biggest challenge that you see right now in terms of personal protective equipment? What would you like to see coming out of this collaboration with engineers?
Well, I think the first thing we learned was about our gaps in testing for personal protective equipment, particularly masks, the search for who could do these tests, and the fact that there was only one center in all of North America that could test for the bacteria testing. And it had to go to Utah, and you know, there was financial usury, for lack of a better word, in terms of, you'd almost call it piracy to a certain extent, to get the testing done that we needed to. They wanted a lot of money to do it. They were getting inundated with people all across North America. But it was really that gap. And while I'm supportive of globalization and supporting everybody else, it absolutely brought out where the gaps are in supply chains when you're in the middle of a pandemic and a crisis. But it also was highlighted, you know, we are fortunate in Hamilton that we haven't had a New York City, that we've been better off than, you know, even our colleagues in Toronto and Montreal who've had it relatively, not horrid, but rough by times. But at the same time, we need to think about our global perspective in Canada about how we might do better. And as we've globalized, we've forgotten that, you know, sometimes local manufacturing is an important thing to have when you hit a crisis and things don't move.
So Ravi, is your group, this transient group that you brought together in the matter of weeks, are they going to be able to help develop this local capacity to create, build personal protective equipment?
Definitely. I think, I mean, that's so the interesting bit of all of these efforts, even though we went in not knowing much about masks and face shields and whatnot, is that we could find very interesting problems in all of these things that from an engineer's are like sort of nectar, right? So in the sense there are material related things that we could do to improve performance of these gears. There are design-related aspects that could be involved as well. And so what we find is, from the perspective of engineering, this could be an industry that is worth disrupting. There's a lot of innovation that could be brought in. And through innovation, we could support local industry. So manufacturing in Canada could be established in a way that Canadian products then tend to get viewed as one of the more innovative and reliable products, and through that you could have potential markup values, right? And what we see also is several avenues that are existing research areas could contribute and benefit in this PPE innovation and development. So for instance, we could integrate masks with sensors that could change color, for instance, that can indicate presence of toxic gases and whatnot, right? So it can go beyond just the medical use. There is requirements for personal protective equipment in a number of areas, like in mining, in petroleum industries, for instance, in firefighting and so on. So that's the way that we tend to view things, is that the initial effort that was put in could then lead to fundamental developments in materials, manufacturing processes, design of devices, not only in the medical area, but in other areas. And so in that context, what we are thinking of doing, and we've started this effort, is to establish this Center for Protective Equipment and Materials that could then be as a hub to collect companies interested in this area, enable a research and development program, and then translate those findings into products that Canadian industry could then put out to the world.
Okay, so for the audience, Masters launched a Center of Excellence in Protective Equipment and Materials that Ravi Selvanagapathy is the inaugural director of. Ravi, can you tell me about, you've described some of the activities, but can you maybe highlight some of the other things that this Center of Excellence is going to be able to achieve?
Yeah, so the focus of the center is, again, to look into innovation, research and development in the area of protective equipments and materials. There are six sort of thematic research areas that we are interested in. The first one is design thinking and design of these personal protective equipment to exactly what the users need. So surprisingly, what we found was many of these masks were not originally designed for medical applications, but were repurposed for medical applications. And therefore, there is a lot of design elements that we could incorporate that make this technology specific for medical applications, specific for mining, specific for industrial applications and whatnot. The other area that we are interested in is in functional materials. So materials is a very strong suit for McMaster. And we want to incorporate many of these expertise in materials in making masks that are much superior than current masks or PPEs that are out there. So for instance, if you have masks which are easily breathable, but provide high levels of protection against particulate matter and bacterial and viral matter. And you can wear them for 8 hours without feeling dizzy for it, right? So then, of course, there will be a significant market for it. So currently, such a product doesn't exist. That is a very important outcome. And those outcomes are mediated by new materials that can be brought in. They are also mediated by new manufacturing methods that can actually create these kinds of filters using nanotechnology and other interesting research that is going on in the university in a cost-effective manner. So again, from the perspective of a consumer product, it has to be cost-effective. It cannot be like a medical device costing thousands of dollars. So balancing the cost, performance, and the user benefit of all of these things is a classical engineering task that the center is bound to do. The other more longer term perspective that we're also taking is one of sustainability. So sustainability is another major theme for the university. And what we find is that as more and more masks and PPEs are used, they're often made from the source material is petroleum products, right? And then they're disposed of, and you're increasingly finding news articles where people are saying that, well, dumps are now being flooded with PPEs, or you're finding this in the watershed, and so on. So this is going to become a persistent and increasing problem as more usage of these personal protective equipments happen. So what we want to do is to use sustainable materials to make these things in a cost-effective manner as well, so that they either biodegrade or they are made from natural materials like paper and other things. So that is another theme. And then the final theme is based on the testing infrastructure that we built up, we would like to create new standards that are, again, specific to the industries that they apply for these personal protective equipment. So we want to work with agencies like Health Canada, Canadian Standards Association, and so on. And we've reached out to them in order to have our people, students and faculty members involved in creating Canadian standards, which hopefully will set global standards as well.
Okay, that's very ambitious. Is there really a market for all of these activities? I mean, how many, I know there is a number of companies tried to step forward to assist during the height of the crisis. How many companies are reaching out to this Center of Excellence for help?
We have so far helped more than 50 companies in dealing with, so there's been a number of companies that have been interested in setting up production facilities, both for the materials as well as for the personal protective equipments themselves, or testing these products. So we help all companies that are interested, and depending on what their interest is, we help them in various ways. One could be just testing the products that they're making. The other could be helping them with the design. The third one could be helping them with manufacture of materials or modifying existing materials that they have. So far we have helped more than 50 companies. We have had continuing conversations with at least 25 to 30 companies or so. And I think these are the companies that would end up forming the core industrial aspect of the center. And what we are hoping to do is to create a forum in which they can come, and these companies span the entire supply chain of manufacturing for the PPEs, so that not only will they find whatever research and development we are doing at the center interesting, but they can have a conversation between themselves in order to find partnerships. And that will create a network that is resilient and will create an ecosystem of expertise and interest in the local area to sustain this as a long-term industry for Ontario.
So, Alison, we're starting to see that there is product being advertised and to a certain extent available. Is there really a need for this local supply chain? Are there any deficiencies in the product that we're that you're seeing available to you now?
Some of our current supply chain has been not to the same quality that one would expect. I went through a box of N95 masks last time I was on service and ended up having four masks that didn't even have elastics on them at the bottom of that box. So there was that sort of quality control. The other thing is, when you wear a mask for up to 12 or 16 hours a day, off for meals and drink and everything else, you get dehydrated, one. But the second thing is that those masks that were currently used for someone who may have any sort of allergies have been horrid. My face itches at the end of the day. So that oral-based material that's used to make most of the common surgical masks right now is really bad for people with allergies. And so some of the local masks that we've been using, in fact, people have put them on and say, hey, this doesn't make my face itch at the end of the day. It's comfortable. I can breathe through it, and I'm not going to have. And we heard at our last masks meeting that it's actually going to be better to produce those masks that are hypoallergenic, for example, because we've got a whole bunch of workers. We have to pay workman's comp to be off because they can't wear the masks in the hospital. So yes, appropriately produced masks that meet modern standards and deal with allergies and face shapes and gender-related face shapes and people who want to have beards and want to be able to work in a hospital at the same time. We should be able to produce a variety of masks or face shields, and we've done some innovative things with face shields as well, that they can work in a hospital environment and feel safe doing that.
I have a question coming from one of the members of the audience that asked the question of what non-technical, non-academic skills have been essential in terms of making this work. Can you maybe give some sense of how you make this kind of rich collaboration? What's required for that?
So I would say I've used my leadership training. So I've had a lot of formal leadership training. And among that was, how do you engage others and make connections? And it has been the new connections that we've made, and who do you tap on to, and being curious. That's another one of those big skills of, okay, we often think of ourselves as curious anyway, if we're in the sciences and STEM. But really being curious about what people's needs are and how we're going to be able to use that. So those are two sort of non-technical skills in terms of being open and innovative and exploring what could be. Because the innovation, I think that, John, that's the other thing. The speed of which we have been innovating for the past 3 months has been unbelievable.
Ravi, do you want to maybe amplify that? And I think you said something earlier that struck me, which is you had people working literally around the clock, hoping that the outcome would never be needed. Mm-hmm. How do you keep a group, brand new group brought together, motivated with that kind of a mandate?
Yeah, I mean, it's been a enlightening journey, right? In the sense that I wouldn't have thought that was possible as well. But I think that is what people are primed to do if they have a higher purpose, right? And that is what is important, right? So far, from an academic perspective, we have our research projects and so on, and we do projects which are impactful, but impactful over the longer term. Here we have a situation where the work that we do can have an immediate impact, and that immediate impact is felt in the local community. And that has a very powerful effect that enables people or makes people want to contribute. And I think that is a key measure that we probably should incorporate into our student training more. And that may be something where the students look at making not only sort of their research thesis, but also have an impact project on the side that they could contribute to, where they can see that immediate result of this. And I think that is the key motivation. And what I would also do is to second Allison's comment, in the sense that in my viewpoint, there are two ways that we can view our sort of contribution and efforts. One is sort of the explorer mentality, and where what you are trying to do is to seek new experiences, and therefore that then becomes the journey, then becomes sort of the important thing. The other one is an empire building mentality, where what you're looking at is the final product or the end goal. So if the end goal produces sufficient result, then it is considered productive. While in the explorer mentality, it is the process that you go through, that it takes through, that is the real reward, right? And in those in that sense, this journey has been a roller coaster kind of journey, but the speed with which things have changed and how people came together is something that I personally will prize 10 years, 20 years down the line, looking back at it, which no end goal can potentially provide, right? So it's that mentality. And everybody has some aspects of both of them. They want to have this explorer thing in some aspects, and then the empire building in the other aspect. And so that is what it satisfies in people.
Okay, so building up collaborative networks purposely, innovating at an unprecedented pace, working towards a higher purpose. My question is, are these lessons that the scientific and engineering community are likely to learn from this pandemic? Are these things going to stick? What do you two think?
I think so. I think the other one is collaboration, John. Collaboration from unlikely partners, right? It wouldn't have been necessarily a way that you, the engineers, would have thought that they could directly connect into the healthcare system. Ravi and I've done this, and we have CHIRP grants, but sometimes those CHIRP grants don't turn into that productivity out the other end quite as quickly. But this has been, you know, my presence there, I hope, has helped the engineers see the healthcare impact of what this pandemic has meant for us, not only just what they're hearing in the news and the altruism of learning about providing something good out the other end beyond the science is, I think, one of those things that I'm going to value for all of this, because I've made new connections that I hadn't anticipated at the beginning of this, and it's taken my research in new directions as well.
Ravi, do you want to maybe comment on that? Do you see us changing the way we do things at McMaster Engineering?
I think so. I think at least on a personal level, I'm going to work on projects that are more impactful. So that's for sure. That's a small change. But I think the team that got involved spanned across all the engineering disciplines in McMaster. And so I hope the experience that they got through this would have changed mentalities there as well, in order to look into things that are impactful to Canada, society, and so on, and to think larger and bigger, right? So that would be the approach. The other important thing that this one accelerated the realization of was that, unlike in the past, we cannot focus only on a small expertise area and be satisfied with contributing to that expertise area throughout our lifetime. We would have to look at opportunities that arise and try to use our expertise in those areas and try to move into new areas and contribute. And this is likely to be the case, the new norm in the research landscape as we move forward, right? And so the faster we adapt to that, the better and more successful we would be. Not only would we survive, but we will also thrive in such a kind of research landscape.
Okay, so I want to give both of you a chance to comment on any other reflections you might have about the projects, the new center, or the COVID-19 crisis in general. Is there anything you would like to add for our audience?
Well, I know that this has been a big change for everybody. You know, students, you know, who've changed how they learn. Researchers who've repurposed labs or rethought about how they're going to do it. The public in general. Is this the last pandemic we'll see? Probably not. Is this going to be one of the longest we've seen in a modern era? Absolutely. Has it reframed how we think about each other? Absolutely. Am I thankful that I live in Canada? 100%. But at the other end of this, I think for me, one of the things has been new connections amongst people that I hadn't thought about. So, you know, out of this, we've got a young engineering faculty, Zainab, who now has a CIHR grant. That's not the usual route for an engineer. She's collaborating with people who've been working in aerosolization for their entire career. And she's bringing me along with a graduate student who's interested in social determinants. So we're going to start building her expertise, our expertise, and really build an interesting new team that's going to help foster engineering careers and a graduate student take her in a pathway she hadn't thought about either.
Ravi, do you want to have anything to add?
I think in the short term, we would overestimate the impact of this pandemic, and in the long term, we would tend to underestimate at this time. So I think it will have a significant change in perspective, as well as in all spheres that we interact with, right? And therefore, sticking to the, so this is a fantastic time to rethink priorities, rethink where we want to sort of take our careers, for instance, or for the even research directions or academic directions for everybody, for the students, for the faculty members, for the faculty itself, and the university. So I think always see this as an opportunity to do better. And that is what we should try to inculcate in all of us, rather than thinking that we will go back to the normal as it was before. No. So I don't think that is going to happen in any sphere of life moving forward.
And it's absolutely clear that because we were called upon to do it, stepping outside of our pre-existing silos was maybe an uncomfortable step, but a very rewarding one in terms of what we're able to accomplish. And once you've made that a habit, I think it'll be hard to go back. Mm-hmm. So with
and
that,
I think the hospitals are grateful for that as well. You know, we are very grateful that the engineering colleagues stepped up to do this because you know, we may have not produced necessarily what's going to be used immediately in this past 3 years or 3 months, but it's going to give us a product that I think in the long term is going to be better for us all. And I'm very grateful to my engineering, my old and my new engineering friends for doing all of this.
Well, and I have to say, Allison, we didn't make this the subject of this podcast, but Allison has been an advocate for making engineers aware of areas where there might be challenges in terms of testing reagents, in terms of testing equipment, in terms of shielding for healthcare workers in changing their workplace. And so there's been a great opportunity for McMaster Engineering to do it. So with that, I would like to wrap up this second episode of Big Ideas for a Changing World. I'd like to thank both Allison and Ravi for giving us some very interesting insights into the early days of the COVID-19 crisis and how the McMaster Engineering and Hamilton Health Science and St. Joe's collaboration has really worked in terms of making a difference, and how it's really changed, opened our eyes as to the kind of things we might be able to accomplish in the future. Thanks for listening to this episode of Big Ideas for a Changing World. If you enjoyed the show, be sure to follow us and let us know your thoughts. We're at McMaster Engineering on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook.